Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Lloyd.
Thank you for being here. Chris is off today, and so Matt Elliott is in with me this morning. Let me tell you, did you hear the thunder and the lightning, the little light show we had overnight?
I sure did, and I saw a lot of the results as I was driving down my street this morning.
Oh, yeah. My street had a lot of water as well. My grass needed it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, it was a little dry. But, yeah, I think I'm done with the rain now. Let's get some sun and, you know.
Friday morning, let's clear it out, and
lower,
let's have a
humidity.
Great weekend here in Michigan, huh?
Exactly. Let me tell you something else that was some fireworks last night, or yesterday afternoon, was the Detroit Tigers, who broke out in a big way at Comerica Park, blasting a season-high 6 home runs and an 11-0 shutout of the Minnesota Twins. Third baseman Colt Keith finally got his first homer of the season in his 63rd game, a 2-run shot in the 6th inning that helped cap off a dominant offensive performance. The power surge included home runs from Spencer Torkelson, Gleyber Torres, Riley Green, others, as Detroit jumped out to an early lead and never looked back. Those guys, I mean, we always said we need the bats to happen, right?
Always did, you know, especially when the arms aren't quite there, you got to have the bats. And that's
exactly.
Three series wins in a row now in June. That's fantastic.
Listen, I still have hope for my Tigers, and we still have a long season to go.
That's right. A lot of games left.
A Macomb County jury has acquitted former Officer James Burke of all charges tied to a 2024 high-speed crash that killed two men in Warren. Jurors returned not guilty verdicts on 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter, along with related charges, after 7 days of testimony. Prosecutors argued that Burke was driving recklessly, nearly 114 miles an hour, without lights or sirens, when his patrol SUV slammed into a Dodge Durango in September of last year, killing Cedric Hayden Jr. and DeJuan Pettis. Defense attorneys argued that the crash was caused by Hayden, who they said was intoxicated and made an unexpected left turn directly in front of Burke's cruiser. The verdict sparked emotional reactions inside the courtroom, with family members of the victims calling the decision unjust. Meanwhile, Burke's family said the acquittal proves the case should never have been brought. The legal battle's not over yet, though. Separate wrongful death suits filed against the city of Warren, and the officers involved are still moving forward in Macomb Circuit Court.
That's a tragedy all the way around.
It is. I don't know. I saw when I see the video of it, you know, and I'm thinking too, you know, no lights, no sirens. You know, that's one thing, but then you have the other guys who, you know, were intoxicated and they made that turn, you know, and sometimes when you're intoxicated, you can't judge how fast a car is coming towards you. And so you think you can make that turn before it gets to you, and it doesn't work that way. I thought we were going to cut a ribbon this morning.
We were hoping.
But it looks like the opening of the long-awaited Gordie Howe International Bridge has been delayed after the Windsor Detroit Bridge Authority abruptly canceled the ribbon-cutting ceremony less than 24 hours before it was scheduled to begin. Now, in a statement, the authority said Canada and the United States agreed to postpone the opening to resolve what it called outstanding issues. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney confirmed the delay came at the request of the U.S. administration, but said there's no great drama going on surrounding the decision. The bridge project has been more than 25 years in the making. Construction started back in 2018. Earlier this year, President Donald Trump threatened to block the crossing amid trade disputes. Governor Gretchen Whitmer says she's still looking forward to attending a ribbon cutting whenever it's scheduled, calling the bridge a major long-term economic win for Michigan.
It absolutely is a long-term win. This will be the busiest border crossing in North America by a long stretch.
And, you know, it came, you know, this delay came, you know, at the request of the U.S. administration. It's got to be more to it than just, you know, Carney says there's no drama, but it's got to be some drama in there somewhere.
Between Carney and the president, I think there's always drama. It's just that Carney is very calm about it.
No, exactly. Well, I hope it gets done because, you know, we can see it here from the 8th floor of the Fisher Building. It is going to really help out in getting our products across
it
the
will.
Border.
Well, and one of the guests we'll talk to today did some work on the Gordie Howe Bridge, as well as a lot of other key monuments and key facilities around the Metro Detroit. So it'll be a fun conversation to talk about that. Would have been more fun with a ribbon.
Ribbon cutting, right, exactly. Federal prosecutors say one of 8 people indicted in an alleged campaign of threats targeting U of M leaders previously worked for the U.S. Senate campaign of Democratic candidate Abdul El-Sayed. According to campaign finance records, 24-year-old Miriam O'Day received salary payments from the campaign earlier this year. Prosecutors accuse O'Day and seven others of using encrypted chats in social media to threaten university officials in an effort to pursue the school to cut ties with Israel amid the war in Gaza. The indictment says the group targeted university leaders, including then-President Santa Ono, between 2023 and 2025. O'Day is also accused of involvement in vandalism at a Metro Detroit business linked to military contracting. El Sayed's campaign says O'Day was an hourly employee who left in April. O'Day faces a federal conspiracy charge carrying a possible five-year prison sentence. Her arraignment is scheduled for July 1st in Detroit. Also, Ford Motor Company recalling more than 548,000 vehicles in the United States over potential safety issue involving the center console. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, chrome plating on the center console in certain 2018 through 2024 Ford Expedition SUVs may bubble and peel over time, creating sharp edges that could injure passengers. Federal regulators say the problem may stem from a supplier using manufacturing processes that failed to meet Ford specifications. Ford dealers will inspect affected vehicles and replace center consoles when necessary at no cost to owners. The automaker says recall notices will be sent to impacted customers with instructions on how to schedule repairs. And also, President Trump nominating federal prosecutor Jay Clayton to serve as the next director of national intelligence, a move coming amid a major political fight over the leadership of the U.S. intelligence community. Trump announcing the pick on social media, urging the Senate to confirm Clayton quickly and praising his legal career, including his time as head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Clayton currently serves as the top federal prosecutor in Manhattan. Time now is 6:13, and Matt, coming up, who do we have at 6:19?
We're going to start off with Garrick Rochow, who's the CEO of CMS Energy, and it'll be a timely thing to talk about. We'll cover, among other things, data centers. Oh. But we'll also ask him about the storms last night and make sure everyone has the lights on.
Absolutely. And here's your chance right now to win a trip to see Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire in the city of your choice. We've got your flights, we've got your hotel, your concert tickets, and premium VIP lounge access covered. It's your chance to sing along all night long with Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind, and Fire. The prize is provided by Live Nation. Text this hour's national keyword, September. Oh, you know that one. September to 95819. That's September to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Play four times each weekday for four chances to win, official rules, and more at WJR.com.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is Matt Elliott. I'm filling in for Chris Renwick this morning. I'm here with Lloyd Jackson. And we also are pleased to welcome our first guest this morning on the show, Garrick Rochow, who is the president and CEO of CMS Energy. Good morning, Garrick.
Good morning, Matt. Good morning, Lloyd.
Good morning.
Great to be on the show.
Thanks for being our first guest this morning and having the early tea time. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's great. The sun's shining, the birds are tweeting.
There we go. And we also had some weather come through overnight, Garrick. Tell us first and foremost how we're doing and are the lights on through the service area.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as anticipated or expected. We expected over 70-mile-an-hour winds. We didn't see that in all areas. There's a few areas in Michigan that had that, just west of the Lansing area and a little bit toward the Indiana border. We're working to restore those customers quickly here today. About 40,000 out in total this morning, and so we should have that cleaned up in short order.
That's great. That's great to hear.
Garrick, you know, we've seen several the severe weather become more frequent across Michigan and in the Midwest. Michigan's energy systems, are they being forced to adapt faster than ever before because of this severe weather we're seeing more frequently?
Definitely more severe weather. Michigan averages 15 tornadoes a year. Last year we saw 33. This year, we've already experienced over 15, so definitely more severe weather. And so we're making investments across the state to improve the electric grid, larger diameter poles, more undergrounding locations, more automation, more crews to be able to restore power quicker for our customers, a number of things to be able to make sure Michigan can adapt to the weather changing and the changing conditions.
Well, Garrick, you just mentioned investment, and we were together at the Mackinac Policy Conference a few weeks ago, and one of the things you were talking a lot about was the investments that that CMS and others are making to support the demand for data centers. And there are lots of opportunities and also some risks that go with those. And You know, I think one of the things you talked about a lot about was that we've got about a 12 to 18 month window to take advantage of the demand for data centers. So maybe it would help our listeners if you could describe what the economic opportunity a data center presents.
I've been in Michigan for three generations, not me, but my family's been in Michigan for three generations. I hope my kids are here for another generation. But we've lost some things in Michigan, and it comes to manufacturing, it comes to jobs, and a whole host of other things. And there's one opportunity out there in terms of data centers, and they're being located in other states. And just to demystify some things, data centers are not new. There's server rooms in the past, right? Each company, hospitals, education systems, nonprofits, businesses had server rooms, and now we're centralizing those in data centers. In addition to all the work, all the social media stuff, and yeah, there's this AI piece that's being developed as well, but a lot of that data center is cloud computing to help Michigan businesses run, whether it's, you know, education systems or financial systems, healthcare and the like. And there's a real opportunity that Michigan is missing out on. I want to make sure as a business leader in the state, and I know that's true for other business leaders, that we're creating opportunities and jobs and investment in Michigan for the next generation. And unfortunately, that's not happening. These data centers are located in other states like Ohio and Indiana, states across the U.S., and Michigan's not getting its fair share, and we should. There's great benefits in terms of jobs, construction jobs, jobs that are there afterwards, and taxes and property taxes that they bring to the state where Michigan residents and communities can benefit. And we believe that we can do that in a very responsible way, from energy, from water, working closely with the hyperscalers to do that in a very responsible way in Michigan. That's what we're trying to promote, those type of investments in Michigan.
Garrick, one of the biggest points here is that existing customers won't subsidize these projects. Explain how these protections actually work.
Michigan has some of the best protections in terms of energy and energy costs in any state in the U.S. And we put that in place back in November of 2025. And so it's already in place and ensures that data centers pay not just their fair share, they pay their whole share of the cost. And so what that does is carries part of the fixed costs that current or existing customers pay, which means electric rates can go down. Our math shows that with one new hyperscaler, about a gigawatt of load, a hyperscaler, that can reduce the average residential bill by $7.50 a month. So there's real savings that we can articulate and benefits just in energy costs, not in addition to all the jobs and property tax benefit and the like.
Now, one of the questions that a lot of consumers have about data centers, Garrick, is the concern around emissions, water use, that sort of thing. There are a few things about the way the laws that we have regarding clean energy drive and fit into this equation. You want to share with us how that works as well?
Yeah, one, there are clean energy laws in the state. And so, again, the system itself will get cleaner, but specifically around water, many of these hyperscalers have committed to low water use, to be using closed-loop cooling systems where they, yes, they do use some water, but it's equivalent to a car wash. It's equivalent to, you know, a golf course. It's certainly less water intensive than maybe the farm where that was originally there. And so there are responsible ways to do that. And I envision this as like for these communities, there should be a gold standard. Think of it as a checklist that community can go through to make sure that those hyperscalers, those data centers are doing it in a very responsible way. From energy, from water, that's the discussion we need to have to make sure we can do this in a responsible way. And that the community, it benefits, right? And those benefits are articulated, whether that's helping the local schools, the local roads, or a property tax break.
And I think that's the absolute key here, Garrick, is what you described as a responsible approach to investing. You know, we can do this in a way that not only drives economic growth, but also protects the environment, protects the local community, and ultimately benefits us all as Michiganders. So we really appreciate your work and your leadership on this issue.
Well, thanks. I want to see my kids. I want to see my kids, and I know a lot of other individuals want to see their kids live in Michigan.
You and me both. And we're grateful I'm grateful anyway to at least have one who's going to stay here for sure. Well, Garrick, we really appreciate your time this morning. We hope you you're able to get the rest of those customers restored. And in the meantime, keep doing the good work on responsible data center development. Thanks, and have a great weekend.
Matt, Lloyd, thank you. Appreciate the time.
Dave Coulter, the Oakland County Executive, is next on JR Morning.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Matt Elliott here sitting in for Chris Renwick. I'm here with Lloyd Jackson. Lloyd, we're going to have Oakland County Executive Dave Coulter on next. Dave, how are you this morning?
Matt, I'm doing really well. How are you, sir?
We are great. It's great to see you. And it was great to see you a few weeks ago on Mackinac, and we're really glad to have you here today. A lot of great things going on in Oakland County, and you and the rest of the county leadership are doing a fantastic job. Right now, all of our citizens are concerned about probably affordability as their number one issue. Tell us a little bit about what you and the rest of the county leadership are doing to help address affordability in Oakland County.
Yeah, it is really the number one thing that I hear from people. It's amazing. And so we've leaned into that. We've tried to do what we can as a county to bring prices down and make life more affordable to folks. We recently made all of our parks free for everybody, all of our residents, so that they can go and get a little enjoyment and recreation without putting out any money, which is a nice thing. But we've also done things like reducing medical debt for folks. We leaned in and erased millions of dollars in medical debt for people. Student loan debt. We have a program to eliminate or at least help to students, former students, eliminate their student loan debt. We're always looking for ways to try to make life more affordable for folks because it really is a lot of pressure on families right now.
And County Executive, you know, even in a county viewed as economically strong, there are still families struggling with housing costs, debt, and rising everyday expenses. You know, and what are you hearing directly from your residents?
Yeah, Lloyd, that's a great point, you know, because Oakland County is viewed as a wealthy county, and in many ways it is. But we have 62 different cities, villages, and townships here in the county, and they're all different. And in many places, people are really struggling. A third of our residents, even in Oakland County, a third of our residents are, by definition, housing insecure. They spend more than a third of their income on housing costs, for instance. So it's a real problem across our county and across our country. And I hear this every day from residents it's not just the fact that, you know, folks are struggling a little bit financially, but it's even broader than that, in that I think there's this growing sense that, you know, this system, this economic system that we're in, is not working for me. I'm having a hard time attaining the American dream and really getting ahead, and what's going on. And I think that fuels a lot of the polarization in our politics these days, this sense that I'm trying my best, I'm working hard, but I'm not getting ahead, mm-hmm. and this should be easier.
And it feels like nothing is easy, Dave, and we appreciate the fact that you and other members of leadership in Oakland County are trying to address these issues. Talk a little bit about all of the work that you and the county are doing at Pontiac, because I think that is a really amazing story about how you're driving economic development and community development in Pontiac and saving the county money.
Yeah, Matt, I appreciate that. You know, one of our communities that has struggled over the years is Pontiac. There's been a lot of disinvestment in Pontiac over the years, but it is our county seat. It used to be where my office was, and so we've made a substantial investment in downtown Pontiac. My office by next year around this time is going to be in downtown Pontiac. And you know, we helped to bring down the Phoenix Center, which was unfortunately a dilapidated parking deck, which was no longer sustainable. And my goal was not that the county itself would be able to just revitalize downtown Pontiac, but that our move there would motivate investors, private sector people, to invest there. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So with our move there announced a couple of years ago, there's already $500 million in private development in the pipeline in downtown Pontiac. And so my office will be down there in a year, like I said. But more importantly, there are more workers, more businesses, More residents coming to downtown Pontiac, and I'm very optimistic about it.
And, you know, Pontiac has an incredible history, county executive, and, you know, some great location advantages as well. You feel the city, you feel it's finally beginning to realize some of that long-awaited potential?
I really do. It's palpable. I see it every day when I'm there. It's really exciting. I've often said if I was younger and richer, I would be investing in Pontiac right now.
Yeah.
Because it really is on the upswing. I think we're going to do in Pontiac what the leadership in Detroit has done in downtown and midtown Detroit. I think that sort of same kind of momentum and prosperity is coming to Pontiac, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. Like I said, not leading the effort, but just being part of the redevelopment of our county seat.
Well, it takes some courage to catalyze that kind of investment and some vision, and we really appreciate the fact that that's happening, because if Pontiac can redevelop just like Detroit has,
yeah,
and can revitalize, that will have a huge impact on the county as a whole and the state, frankly. So that's great work. You know,
I think so. And by the way, one of the other things is, you know, I'm on the older side, but young people want an urban, walkable kind of experience to live in, to raise their families, to work in. And we don't really have that in Oakland County. You can go to Detroit, and I love all the progress in Detroit, but we don't really have in Oakland County that sort of urban experience that younger people want. And I hope this helps keep people in our region, helps keep them in Southeast Michigan and in Oakland County.
Well, that's great. Now, one other thing about the region that's really important is something that's coming up actually in Wayne County, which is a millage regarding transit. You know, Oakland County passed a transit millage in 22, and there's another millage vote coming up in Wayne County. Tell us a little bit about how important that is for the three major counties in the region.
It's huge, and I really encourage the voters of Wayne County to support that millage. And I applaud Warren Evans for putting that on the ballot this year. It's really the last major foundational piece that we need to do transit in Metro Detroit. Wayne and Oakland used to be opt-out communities where you could just, if a community wanted to have transit, they could. If they didn't, and it doesn't work that way. You can't get federal dollars that way. You can't build a regional system that way. And so, like you said, we did it a couple of years ago. We are now an all opt-in transit system in Oakland County. And when Wayne does that, and I think they will, it's going to be the last piece for us to get the federal dollars to put a regional plan in place to make sure that we have integrated transit systems that work wherever you are in the region. And I think it's huge. And by the way, I will tell the folks in Wayne County, the voters that are thinking about this, that we've seen our transit numbers, our ridership numbers explode since we did ours. If you build it and you do it right and you make it convenient and affordable, people will use it. And I think the same thing can happen in Wayne County.
Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, we know that transit is one of the major drivers of being able to drive employment and success in any region, mm-hmm, in any city. So let's hope that we're able to unify those three systems together and drive a great one. David Coulter,
yes,
the Oakland County Executive, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We hope you have a great weekend.
Matt and Lloyd, great to talk to you. Matt, always good to see you. And great job on the show. Keep it up.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. You know, Matt, the Wayne County Executive says that cooperation is now the new currency. And I really believe that. You know, when you think of these three guys, you know, the Wayne County Executive, the Oakland County Executive, the Macomb County Executive, Mark Hackle, you know, these guys work really well together, and it helps the region.
It hasn't always been that way.
No, and, it hasn't.
You know, we're always better when we're an and. You know, when we can do Oakland, Macomb, and Wayne, we're always better than if it's going alone.
Who's coming up next, Matt?
Well, next we're going to talk to the CEO of the Skillman Foundation, Angelique Power. She's an amazing powerhouse, not just in the city but across the state. She was a 2025 Michiganian of the Year, according to Detroit News, and so we're looking forward to having that conversation.
And she's also the co-host of a show I do with her each month called Our State of Education. We'll talk to her about that as well. That's at 6:49 on JR Morning.
Well, good morning, everybody. It is Matt Elliott here with Lloyd Jackson. Lloyd, we're going to have a great guest coming up
I know her very well.
we're happy to bring in Angelique Power, who is the president and CEO of the Skillman Foundation. Angelique, how are you this morning?
Hi, guys. I'm doing great. I'm so excited for you, Matt, that you get to have this show with one of my favorites, Lloyd Jackson, and welcome to the WJR family.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much. I'm having a lot of fun so far, even with the 4 a.m. wake up. I'm getting used to that, too. So, Angelique, you and I have known each other for a long time, and I'm familiar personally with the amazing work that the Skillman Foundation does, and it's really deep focus on Detroit. But for our listeners, give us a little background on what the Skillman Foundation does.
Sure. Thank you. We are a 60-plus-year-old private foundation, which means we have dollars that we can invest in our communities in ways to make them stronger. So at Skillman, we focus on public education. We give about $28 million annually, and we use it to root deeply in community solutions and then connect community solutions to policy levers for massive change for young people. So it's a swing for the fences. We call it people-powered education. And I'll say we have four goals, and I know that one of them deeply aligns to you and your work, Matt. But one is we are guided by our neighbors and communities, so we invest deeply in Detroit. The second is that we pull those big policy levers, so we work across the state and with folks in Lansing. The third is that we build common ground to do it. And that's the only way that we solve this for the long term. And the fourth is that we do it with our values at the center of everything we do.
Angelique, you know, you spend a lot of time listening to educators and students, and parents and community leaders. What's something that young people are telling adults right now that you think maybe we're still not hearing clearly enough?
Yeah, you know, I think that young people are saying, don't leave us out of the solution. You know, there's a lot of focus right now, which I'm grateful for, that Michigan needs to do something about public education. We've heard now from several places that we're 44th in terms of education outcomes in the nation. We didn't get there overnight. It actually isn't an incremental solution. It's going to take a lot of folks revamping curriculum, getting a vision together, getting our structure together, and more. But youth are saying, we actually have a systems analysis. We've grown up where we've seen the world shut down in COVID. We've actually had to come online really quickly in terms of technology. A big part of our lives are intersectional in terms of understanding how interconnected everything is, and our solutions are interconnected too. So at Skillman, we have youth on our board. We have youth grant makers. We know that they are, you know, sort of users of the public education system. 9 out of 10 young people in Michigan go to public schools. And to create an upgrade for a system without the client and the user there makes no sense. So youth are saying, put us at the table, give us equal billing, and let us help solve one of our bigger issues in Michigan.
You know, Angelique, as the son of a public school teacher, my dad taught in middle school in Lansing for 31 years. That's music to my ears of having, you know, basically the customer involved in the process. One of the other things that you have to do in order to get your job done and do it as effectively as you do is lean into tough conversations. And you do a lot of great work to find common ground across lots of different political divides, philosophical divides, and incentive divides. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned on how to make that work.
You know, I would say listening is such a big part of it. And it is important for that third goal we have at Skillman, but honestly, it's kind of the antidote to this polarized world that we live in. You know, whether it's the way that people want to solve problems in silos, or whether it's the sort of pack of vitriolic commenters that can be released on social media at any given time. None of it is productive, and there's a sort of inhumane quality about it. So for me, what I try to do, when I started at Skillman 5 years ago, I started committing to a year of listening to folks, which could sound cliche a little bit, like, I'm going to go listen to people. But it really is a practice of sort of opening yourself up to what folks are really saying. So after every listening session, within 7 days, we would write up what we heard, and we would return to people and say, this is what we heard. Is this what you said? And often it wasn't, because we listen for what we want to have affirmed. And those are the things that like click with us. And so folks had a chance to really not only speak to us, but correct our understanding and shape the way that we see the world with them, and also shape the strategy that comes from that. So that's for external. That's a practice we use, but that's also a practice I use internally as well.
Angelique, we have just about a minute left, and I got to ask you, you know, one thing I appreciate about our monthly, our State of Education conversations here on WJR is that we really try to talk honestly about both the struggles and the successes. And I believe it was really important to you to create a space for those types of deeper discussions.
Yes, it was. And thank you for that. You know, WJR actually reaches people across the state of Michigan, and we get to join conversations in progress and bring real talk to education issues that sometimes people feel left out of. So, and I get to hang out with you, Lloyd. So, you know, it's always good. And thank you, Matt, for bringing me on your inaugural show. I can't wait to see what you get up to here.
Well, I appreciate that. But more than that, I think, Angelique, what I'm fired up about is to see and hear more of what you do. You know, we were on the island a few weeks ago, and we talked a lot about the fact that most people in the state of Michigan think our education system's doing okay, when in fact it's not, and it's getting worse. So what kind of leadership do you think, this is the last bit, you know, what kind of leadership do you think it requires of all of us, not just folks like you, for us to drive more success here in the state?
You know, I think that it takes both it takes courage to actually not only recognize a problem, but to work across difference to solve it. I think we're living at a time where people can study the issue, but to actually solve it, it takes bridging, it takes testing, and it takes commitment to what we're trying to do. You know, the other thing people talked about on the island is the Michigan 180, where we flip back and forth based on our political stripes. This is bigger than that. This has to do with making sure every child in Michigan succeeds so that Michigan can succeed. So we have to have that vision, and then we have to stick to it. And I'm saying stick to it for at least 10 years. So we correct in terms of data of where we need to improve, but we don't keep flipping back and forth based on the team that we are rooting for.
Yep. So commitment and consistency, that's a great way to leave it. Angelique Power, yeah. CEO of Skillman Foundation. Thank you so much, and have a great weekend, Angelique.
Talk to you guys later. Bye.
And who do we have coming up at 7:05?
7:05, we have Kim Montague, who is the CEO and president of Albert Kahn Associates.
Who built this building?
You got it. We're sitting in Albert Kahn's building, and their offices are in this building, too. And this will be a fascinating conversation.
That's next on JR Morning. Just all around good guy.
I don't know where activist came from. That's a new one for me. Remember, I'm a recovering banker, so that's usually those don't go together, but I'll take it.
Okay.
Well, Lloyd, we are lucky to be joined right now by Kim Montague. Kim is the CEO and president of Albert Kahn Associates. So Albert Kahn is the Albert Kahn.
Yes. I mean, we're sitting in an Albert Kahn building
you
right now.
It. And Kim Montague is the Kim Montague. Kim, good morning. We're glad to have you.
Good morning, Matt. How are you today? Happy Friday.
Thank you, and happy Friday to you, too. We're doing great. So, you know, I think a lot of people may be surprised to learn, Kim, that Albert Kahn, you know, the famous architect here around Detroit, had a firm that still survives today. Give us a little bit of a background or an overview of just how important Albert Kahn was, not only to Detroit, but to the United States.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the Fisher Building, and we're lucky enough to be on the 18th and 19th floor of that building and take a look at the Detroit skyline on a daily basis and see how Albert and his brothers really built the skyline of Detroit and beyond. They started their business as an industrial architect and working with Henry Ford on some of the very first factories that brought us the industrial age. That really started the process, this multidisciplinary approach to architecture and engineering. So we're proud to be part of that legacy and really continuing that legacy forward.
Kim, you know, you're leading a 131-year-old firm and a firm that has, you know, deep history and identity here. How do you honor that legacy while also pushing it forward into a very different future?
You know, it's a great question, and I'll tell you that's something that we think about on a daily basis. How can we continue to honor the legacy, but really looking at our business and what is propelling us forward? And, you know, there's two letters that we can't forget about, and that's AI. And we're incorporating that into our business today and really thinking about how technology can push us forward and think about design differently using those tools. But I will say this, we have, with our multidisciplinary approach and having architects and engineers sitting side by side working together on solutions for our clients, it really, we believe, gives us that unique perspective, honors the legacy, and really challenges us to think about how to do things a little bit differently, challenge that status quo, if you will.
Well, you know what, Kim, by challenging that status quo, you've been getting noticed. So you just won an award. You're the 2026 AIA Michigan Firm of the Year. So tell us a little bit about what that means and also, you know, the work it's taken to get there.
You know, it's funny. We had that celebration just this last Friday, and we had 24 of us in attendance. And we all got up on stage and cheered and realized that, you know, the work is not done there. But, you know, I have to say, being part of this firm that is just so incredibly dedicated to the work that we do, you know, we're one of the few firms that has retained its name and its legacy for, you know, for the time that the firm has been in existence. One of the things that we really focus on, we call it, and Matt, I think I've spoken to you about this, we call it Gems to Giants. So we think about our work in a variety of ways. How can we have impact on the communities that we serve? And, you know, at the same time, helping our clients really think about their business and how they can do their business better.
And it's amazing to think about the fact that you're trying to design buildings that will have a life that will span multiple generations, multiple iterations of technology. You know, just think about how the world of work will change in the next 20 years with AI. How do you think about designing for that?
It, you know, it's probably a completely overused term, but, you know, flexibility is really key. And as much as we can, allowing those structures, those buildings to adapt to the future, to an unknown future, which is honestly sometimes the biggest challenge in and of itself. We have a process that we call LEAD, L-E-A-D, listen, engage, advance, and deliver. And, you know, the listening part is really the piece that I think requires the most discipline, listening to your clients, helping to understand their business. Because remember, after we're done designing this building and the contractor is done constructing this building, our clients are the ones that have to live with it for the next, you know, 20, 30, 40, in some cases, like the Fisher Building, 100 years.
Kim, you've worked your way into a top leadership role in the field that has historically been male-dominated. For young women or young people generally who want to go into architecture or design, what do you wish more people told you early in your career?
Well, somebody told me not to be a doctor because I flunked organic chemistry. So, you know, some may say I kind of fell into this profession, but, you know, honestly, it's a desire, I think, to really think about communities and the impact of what we design as architects and engineers and how that influences daily life, you know, from your home to your place of worship to, you know, where you buy your groceries. Somebody was behind the design of that building and how it functions and the impact that it can have on interactions and relationships formed and what have you. So for me, it's an exceptionally exciting industry to be part of. When I started, we were about 20% women in the industry. And now in most of the architectural schools here locally, it's about 50-50, about 50% women, 50% men. So there has been this evolution of using design thinking and really not just being an architect, but using that design thinking approach in all aspects of business.
Well, Kim, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing the legacy of the Albert Kahn firm and also just sharing a little bit more about how you think about leading a firm with that legacy into, as you said earlier, a future that's going to be rapidly changing and uncertain. Yeah, I guess the last thing is that you're also chairing the 2026 Go Red for Women campaign. We've got about 15 seconds left. What should we know about that?
Well, we just completed the Heart Walk last weekend, and donations are still available. Heart disease is one of the top killers of women. So to all you men out there and ladies out there, support your loved ones and donate to the American Heart Association.
Well, Kim Montague, CEO and president of Albert Kahn Associates, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate it.
And thank you.
Up the great work.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You as well. And now it's time for WJR Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We wreck your world. Here is Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Looking for new ways to drive awareness and traction to your business and what it is that you sell? Well, there's a powerful way to do that in the form of what's known as gamification that might be the magic bullet. New research carried out by TMS, a global technology marketing and sourcing company, has just published the Gamified Customer Journey white paper, drawing on proprietary research with over 1,200 UK and US consumers participating in a poll which highlights how to effectively use gamification across the customer lifecycle and what's working and what's not. Now, this research makes clear that consumers are increasingly embracing gamified brand experiences. What is gamification? Well, it's a strategic tool that boosts user engagement, loyalty, and emotional connection across the customer journey when used effectively. Gamification uses game-like mechanics such as awarding points, badges, leaderboards, and challenges to boost customer engagement, reward customers for taking certain actions, and being loyal to the business. Common gamification mechanics include point systems, badges and achievements, leaderboards, progress bars, and levels. It's likely as a consumer you've encountered some of these game-like mechanics. Here are some key highlights from the research. First, the bottom line, 3/4, 72% of the consumers polled indicated that they have opted in to participate in gamified brand experiences. And 1/3 said gamified interactions motivate them to make a first purchase when they otherwise might not. 85% of consumers appreciate gamification and loyalty programs and encourage them to participate more deeply and be motivated more deeply by them. However, while clearly effective to be successful with gamification as a tool of engagement and loyalty reward, the findings also suggest that simplicity and immediacy are critical to success. Nearly 2/3, 62% of consumers, for example, said the ideal gamified experience should last no longer than 5 minutes. Marius Freilich, Associate Director, Engagement Strategy at TMS, said this about the results: gamification has been one of the most powerful tools available to brands. So there you have it. Looking for a way to create a little fun in the purchase journey you offer your consumers? Try gamification. It's clearly proving effective. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Matt Elliott here along with Lloyd Jackson. Lloyd, we've got a great guest coming up. His name is Adrian Lewis. He's the president and CEO of Forgotten Harvest. Adrian, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Matt. Good morning, Lloyd.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're glad to have you here. So, you know, Adrian, you really address one of the biggest issues that a lot of our citizens here in Metro Detroit deal with, which is food insecurity. Tell us a little bit about how important of an issue or how big of an issue it is for us in Metro Detroit, and in particular, what happens in the summer?
Yes. It's the summer. This has been an issue for quite some time, but for some reason, it seems to be very expanded during this particular summer. During the summer months, as we would imagine, many of our school kids, ages, 7 through 18, they truly do depend on the lunches that our school system provides. And Forgotten Harvest has traditionally stepped up to make sure that we are being a provider to help fill in that gap. This year, we're making some expanded efforts to make sure that our children are being fed this summer.
And, you know, you're talking about distributing more than 200,000 meals this summer. And, you know, when you hear that number out loud, what does that say about the level of need right now in our community?
It says a lot. It says that, this is definitely going to help supplement that gap. But you know, when we really look at the complexity of the challenge this summer, it's really a big help, but also it spells out that there must be even a greater need.
Well, that need is always persistent, and when our school kids are out and they don't get that free breakfast and free lunch, it becomes even more important that organizations like Forgotten Harvest step in. Tell us a little bit about what powers Forgotten Harvest. And I know it's donations, but it's also a lot about volunteering.
Absolutely. We definitely wouldn't be able to do the level of mission and scale that we do in terms of distributing close to 50 million pounds of fresh, nutritious surplus foods each year, which is equivalent to about 40 million meals. To be able to do that, it takes volunteers. And last year, we had a total of about 35,000 volunteer efforts that were able to help with that mission. And this year, it's going to take the same, if not more.
You know, I've been a volunteer at Forgotten Harvest many times.
Me as well.
And I think,
yes.
Lord, you have too. It's a great experience. And frankly, it's also a summer activity that a lot of our listeners could do with their kids, for example. To be able to help out and give back, but also, you know, help you fulfill your mission. Tell us a little bit about how our listeners can get involved as a volunteer at Forgotten Harvest this summer.
I'll be happy to do that. Volunteers could definitely get involved by visiting our website, www.forgottenharvest.org. We have volunteer opportunities at our Oak Park warehouse. We have a 100-acre farm that's also in need of volunteers, and just special opportunities for long-term volunteerism as well. As we would imagine, you know, this need is consistent throughout the entire year, and to have that consistency in the volunteer. And I'm so glad to hear that the two of you have experienced it, because it's not just a volunteer effort, it's a volunteer experience. And to be able to understand the total impact and complexity that goes into our work, we're always happy to share that.
It's really like family. I you know, when I was there before and helping out, I felt like I was there with family. For parents that are listening who may need help this summer, Adrian, but they may feel a little embarrassed or hesitant to ask, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say that I've had that lived experience, and I know what it's like. And I would strongly encourage them to trust that Forgotten Harvest is a place that you will be embraced for your need, and there is no judgment. But also, they could call 211 to find out what specific site is convenient or best for them. And also visit our website, www.forgottenharvest.org. Both of those outlets, again, we're there. We're ready to assist and really, you know, feed those that are hungry. No one in America, more especially Metro Detroit, should be hungry.
Well, Lloyd, that is absolutely true. One last thing about that minute or that experience in the 30 seconds we have left. You've done some work to revamp the experience for someone who's coming to Forgotten Harvest. Tell us real quickly a little bit about what that's like. What could someone expect if they're a first-time user?
Well, if they're first-time users, they can expect, that it's a safe environment, that it's, you know, food safety is of the utmost importance to us, but also curating that experience, understanding where the food is going and how it's being acquired in some aspects.
Well, Adrian Lewis, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we need to hit the break here. But, Adrian, you've done a phenomenal job of curating that experience so it's respectful and comfortable. So thank you for your leadership, and thanks for helping us out here in Metro Detroit.
I'm so happy to be part of it. So thank you again for having me.
Have a great weekend. Well, good morning, everyone. It's Matt Elliott here with Lloyd Jackson, and we are happy and proud to welcome in Mike Kozak, who's the president and partner of Giffels Webster, a civil engineering firm here in Detroit. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, guys. How are you?
We're good.
We are fantastic. So, Mike, you're the president and a partner of a 74-year-old civil engineering firm. Tell us a little bit about, for those of us who are not engineers, I wasn't smart enough to get an engineering degree. I ended up as a finance major. So tell us a little bit about what civil engineers do and maybe some of the impact that you've had across your firm has had across Metro Detroit?
Sure. Yeah. Our, like you said, our core business is civil engineering. We're a collection of civil engineers, but supported strongly by a team of surveyors, landscape architecture, community planners, GIS specialists. And, you know, we are really responsible for the planning, the design, and supervision of construction projects, infrastructure projects. So you're thinking roads, water mains, sewers, all the things kind of below the surface that you don't see necessarily every single day, and you hope that they're working every single day, but when they don't, we certainly get some attention. So our business is split really between working for private developers, primarily in the city of Detroit with the large redevelopment projects that have happened here recently, private development in the suburbs, so your commercial, residential, and then a large part of it is working for municipalities throughout Southeast Michigan, and that's communities that are both still growing and expanding and building new infrastructure to serve new residents and new businesses, and communities that are investing in really the rehabilitation of their communities.
You know, Mike, your firm has been involved in some of Detroit's biggest transformation projects. I'm talking about Little Caesars, Michigan Central, Hudson's Detroit Development. When you look at the skyline today, does it feel a little surreal seeing projects your team has helped shape?
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm actually sitting in our headquarters downtown right now in Grand Circus Park, and I can look out the window and see the Hudson's Tower that rose there recently and all the exciting things that have happened there. We had surveying crews working on that building to make sure that it rose straight and true as it became one of the newest size skyscrapers in Detroit. And we could watch them from our office, literally from our windows. We'd see them out there on very cold mornings and in the wintertime, standing out there making sure that everything was done right. So yeah, it's been amazing to see just the consistent reinvestment in the city and all of the spoils that have come along with that.
You know, one of the other major structures that will be hopefully opening soon here in Detroit
hopefully,
is the Gordie Howe Bridge. Tell us a little bit about the work you did there to make sure that project went off correctly.
Yeah, that one was interesting in that none of our design teams actually worked on that project. That was a survey-led project where we were working. Usually our clients on the design side, like I said, are land developers or municipalities. In this case, it was our survey crews that were working directly for the contractors that were building the plaza on the U.S. side. So we were responsible for providing survey layout for all of the stormwater improvements there. You can think of all the building and pavements that represent that plaza that all has to drain somewhere. And then all the underground electrical conduits, miles and miles of conduits serving that building and the bridge itself. So that one, we had teams out there for, you know, years in a row that really spent time and we're committed to that project. And yeah, we're also very excited to see it open. I was hopeful. Yeah. We headed to Toronto next week for the World Cup, and I was hopeful that we would be able to drive across that bridge. And I don't know that it's going to happen now, but we'll see.
Well, you know, there's also, Mike, a growing conversation about sustainability and resiliency. How much has climate and environmental planning become part of modern civil engineering?
It's a big part, and really the change that we've seen, particularly on the stormwater management side and the investment that communities are making in helping to, you know, plan for the future and work with the infrastructure that they have in place now. But, you know, as climate change and storms become more intense, we have to plan for that. And it's not an overnight reaction. It really has to happen kind of systematically and slowly, so people understand standards changing. But it's a really important thing that everybody needs to be thinking about, because our systems that are in place now that were built 50, 75 years ago are not prepared for what's coming down the road.
You know, you've been working in the city for over 70 years, 74 years to be exact, and you've learned a thing or two about what's underground here around Detroit. And I think that's one of the things that's made your firm as effective as it is. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to dig into the ground here in Metro Detroit, in particular in the city, and what are the kinds of things that you have to plan for?
It's complicated, as you would expect. The spider web or spaghetti noodles that are underneath most of these streets really present a challenge. So it's about putting together a team, a development team that understands that, that includes design professionals. And when it comes to the construction, it includes the right contractors that are prepared for that work and understand the pitfalls that can come. And it's about being, you know, kind of resilient during the project and being able to adjust things as you find underground assets that maybe weren't where they're supposed to be or aren't in the same size or condition that they were supposed to be, but, you know, really adjusting your design to accommodate that and keep the project moving forward as efficiently as possible.
Mike, we got about a minute left. You know, a lot of students don't even know what civil engineering or surveying really is. How do we better expose young people to these careers?
Yeah, that's been a challenge for us. We're really trying to reinvest in an internship program with college students, but they've already made the decision to do that. So we reach out at the high school level. We attend middle school and high school career fairs. Our ownership team goes to their kids' schools and speak on career days and really tries to impress upon people how important it is that we manage these assets and that we get people, good people, to come into this industry that are passionate about it.
You know, Mike, I'm really glad to hear that you do that. As a former banker, my best clients did that exact thing. They went into the schools to demonstrate what their work is. You know, you can't be what you can't see.
That's right.
And so by doing that work, it makes a huge difference. So thank you, number one, for the work you do. And also thank you for getting into our schools and showing the art of the possible to students. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate the time.
Who's coming up at 7:49?
7:49, we have Hillary Doe, who is the head of Move Detroit for the city of Detroit. She's part of Mayor Sheffield's, you know, population growth initiative head, and she'll be a great guest. We'll have a lot of fun talking to Hillary.
But first, it's Automotive Views with Mike Martinez, brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Learn more at michiganbusiness.org.
Ford left a lot of crossover customers without a home when it discontinued the Edge in 2024 and the Escape last year. But its dealers have found success keeping them in the fold with a surprising but familiar name, the Ford Explorer. Sales of the Explorer are up 18% through May. Meanwhile, Ford's two closest alternatives to the Escape in size and price have seen declines, with the Bronco Sport slipping 1.5% and the Maverick down 12%. Just how has Ford convinced buyers of smaller, more affordable vehicles to shell out more money? Dealers say the company offered Escape and Edge buyers up to $10,000 in private offers to stay in the Ford family. Coincidentally, the cheapest Explorer is about $10,000 more than the cheapest Escape. It's also a known entity. Explorer has well over 30 years of brand cachet as one of the pioneering vehicles of the 1990s SUV boom. It's proven quite versatile over the years and is doing so again today. For this week's Automotive View, I'm Mike Martinez with Automotive News.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Matt Elliott here filling in for Chris Renwick. I'm with Lloyd Jackson.
And good morning.
Good morning. And Lloyd, we have a great guest with us. We have Hillary Doe, who is the head of Move Detroit for the city of Detroit. Good morning, Hillary.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And she's also known, a.k.a. Hillary, what up, Doe?
Thanks so much.
Lloyd and I were just betting on who was going to say it first.
Hillary. I had to say it. Definitely. That's yeah, very good.
Well, Hillary, number one, it was great to see you very briefly on Mackinac. I thought that the entire group from the city of Detroit, Mayor Sheffield and all of her administration, really had a lot of great things to talk about, and in particular, Move Detroit. So maybe you could share with our listeners what Move Detroit's mission is and how it fits into the mayor's overall vision for the city.
For sure. Yeah. You know, I'm so excited to get the chance to, you know, head up this effort. And as you say, the mayor actually, you know, announced our sort of first program together as part of her State of the City announcement. And she's really committed to, you know, the growth of the city. And a key part of that is our economic growth, as well as our population growth, which really requires that folks who are already here will can choose to stay, can get connected to opportunity and continue to choose Detroit. Former Detroiters across the country can, you know, decide to come back home, and new folks who maybe haven't considered Detroit in the past can join us and help build the future right here in the city. And that's really, Move Detroit is really helping to facilitate that. It's this first in the nation public-private partnership dedicated to population growth. So the mayor will, you know, sit on Move Detroit's board, but it's this, you know, independent entity that's a coalition of 50 plus organizations across the city including corporate partners, community organizations, 5+ university partners, foundations, you name it. And we're all really locking arms to work together to make sure that we're delivering on that promise of growth for the city.
Hillary, you know, some people hear population growth strategy and they think of it in like abstract terms. But population growth is so directly tied to things like neighborhood investment in schools and even city services.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it is so directly tied to our day-to-day lives. That's actually why, you know, I care about it so much and I'm willing to dedicate, you know, my life hours to it because, you know, think about it. You don't make the choice about where you're going to live once, right? You make it over and over and over again. And it's, you know, not abstract. It's based on your ability, you know, to get connected to opportunity, the decision that you think you can raise your kids there and, you know, build a good life there. So it's exactly what you say, right? It's can I get great opportunities here? Are there great places here for me? Housing, you know, walkable communities. Are there great education systems? And is there a welcoming community for here that I can be a part of? All those things are really tangible, and there's things that we can work together on to continue, you know, making better. And critically, that we need to tell the story of here in our state and across the country.
Now, Hillary, we've here in the city, we've been able to grow the population for 3 years in a row now, and Michigan as a whole grew its population for the first time in decades just this past year by a little bit, by about 28,000 people.
Yep.
What are some of the key programs and initiatives that you and the rest of the team at Move Detroit are driving to help accelerate that growth in the city in particular?
Yeah, you know, first, I would say that we should all be really proud of, you know, that growth. It is the result of thousands of people working on this, you know, for a long time. And even though the numbers might seem small, it's actually as a percentage, you know, faster growth than the rest of the region, faster growth than, you know, any city in the Northeast. There's real stuff to be proud of there. And it's just the beginning. We absolutely need to keep going. I say that, you know, our GPS arrow is now pointed in the right direction. We have not arrived at our destination. You know, initiatives like Move Detroit are really critical at this moment. While we have wind at our back, we've learned a lot. But, you know, we're really at the beginning of making some of these critical investments. So we're doing things like what the mayor announced at State of the City, a talent retention and attraction effort called Make Detroit Home, where existing Detroiters and former Detroiters, boomerangs, who are trying to get back home, can apply for up to $15,000 in support to get, you know, their feet on the ground here and invest in even more roots here by getting access to home ownership, down payment support, or investment in their businesses, because we know our small businesses and our entrepreneurs have this outsized impact on growth as job creators in their communities. That's one initiative. And there are many more to come, everything from field trips to ensure that our university students in the area and our Detroit youth get exposure to all the great communities and neighborhoods and job opportunities right here in the city. That's critically important and really high impact. And even neighborhood ambassador programs, so our neighbors here across the city start to tell Detroit's story and are really the face for, you know, that marketing effort for Detroit.
And Hillary, you know, when people hear all of this, you know, population growth, economic strategy, neighborhood investment, what's the one mm-hmm. thing you want them to understand about where Detroit is headed now?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the one thing I want folks to take away when they hear about Move Detroit is that they can be a part of it. And we actively want them to be. Growth is a group project. We need everybody. And that means we need everyone's, you know, feedback so we can build a vision for, you know, the kind of place we want to make together. And there's a way for folks to be actively involved. This is truly a coalition. So folks can give us feedback on what they love about their place, but also what could be between them and building their future here that can get directly poured into, you know, action that folks take, priorities, program design. And, you know, we can actively, you know, be building this thing together. I think that's why we were successful at the state level for the last few years when I was the state's chief growth officer, really starting to, you know, kickstart growth in communities across the state. And I think that'll be the key to our success here in the city.
I think it's great, Hillary, that you've already built a bit of a playbook at the state level that you can bring to bear here in the city. And I really love this idea of field trips. You know, I do a lot mm-hmm. of work with Michigan State, and we'll have Laura Lee McIntyre, who's the provost of MSU, who will be our next guest after the top of the hour. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about how you're engaging not only with universities like MSU, but also with Detroit Public Schools and other school systems.
actually have a call with them later today. I'm sure public schools to chat more about this. But, you know, it's critically important. I talk about our exposure quotient a lot. That's sort of a term that I think is important for us to think about. Maybe this is a silly example, but I think it's one for us to get our heads around if we think about, you know, some of these schools elsewhere. So say, you know, Yale students. The odds that a student at Yale would graduate having never been to New York City, minuscule, you know, very, very, yep. very few of their students, less than 10% probably graduate with having never had that experience. But if you went to University of Michigan, there's a lot of out-of-state students that, you know, go there, and frankly, in-state students that go who maybe graduate making the decision about where they're going to build their future, having never had an immersive Detroit experience. And so, you know, how can you make a good informed decision? And similarly, we want to make sure that our youth here in Detroit have a full picture of all the job opportunities, of all their neighborhood opportunities, a full picture of how we compare our housing prices, our, you know, fast-growing industries that we're leading the nation in things like clean energy. We have the fastest-growing startup ecosystem in the country, so that they can make their choices about where they want to live today. And also, if they go stretch their legs somewhere else, they can make their choice about whether they want to come home with their eyes wide open. So we're having conversations with those educational institutions to really build these experiences together.
That's fantastic. So Hillary Doe, head of Move Detroit for the city of Detroit, thank you very much for joining us, and thanks for helping us grow the city.
Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Matt Elliott here with Lloyd Jackson. Lloyd, we are lucky enough to have Laura Lee McIntyre, who's the provost from Michigan State, joining us next. Laura Lee, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Nice to be here, Matt.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, you and I have known each other for a bit, and I've got to know the university, and so I know what provost means. I know how important that title is. To me, it's like the chief academic officer of the university. But first and foremost, if you can describe for everybody what just the scope of the responsibility of a provost is, especially at a place as large as MSU.
Such a great question, and a question that I get a lot, especially from my kids. Now, what exactly do you do, Mom? The provost is, like you said, the chief academic officer. I oversee our academic enterprise at Michigan State University. We've got 52,000 students and 17 colleges, so my work really involves elevating and supporting the academic mission, setting the stage, setting the tone, and the initiatives for our academic work, and supporting student success. So I collaborate with our 17 academic deans. We have vice provosts that help promote the work. I work closely with our vice president for research and innovation, because our academic mission goes hand in glove with our research mission, research and innovation. I work closely with our senior vice president for finance. So the academic mission really spans the entire university, and it's a lot of coordinating and elevating and vision setting, but ultimately it involves student success, centering students in every single decision that we make, working closely with faculty and our academic leadership to enact our academic mission. And it's a mission that I'm so excited to be a part of. We've been around since 1855. And we are difference makers in the state of Michigan, but frankly, we are a global institution, and so our reach is far and wide.
Provost, you're responsible for preparing students for jobs that in many cases don't even exist yet. How do you design an education system for a future that's constantly changing?
We have to be nimble, and that's not one of the things that higher education is known for. And so we're thinking out of the box, and I'd love to share a little bit about our work in the Green and White Council. Matt Elliott knows this work well. He and Sanjay Gupta co-chaired the Green and White Council, which was an initiative that President Kevin Gutskowitz enacted last year. We brought together 17 industry leaders in the state of Michigan, spanning all industries and sectors, and really the focus was to think about how we deliver and develop talent for in-demand jobs across the state and equip our Spartans with the skills for the future. So we spent a lot of time listening and talking with these industry leaders and picking their brains and identifying their needs and the gaps that they see and the evolving industries and how we as a partner could prepare students for those jobs of the future. Another thing that came out of those conversations was
how can we connect Spartans to great companies and careers in Michigan and beyond? We've got an alumni base of 360,000 alumni, living alumni in the state of Michigan. And when we look across the globe, it's 560,000 living alumni. So how can we be more intentional about connecting our Spartans to great companies so that they stay in Michigan or they thrive elsewhere, but they're connected to those careers? And then, of course, as a R1 research intensive institution, how can we use our cutting edge research and intellectual property to propel Michigan's economy? So we tapped the brains of these industry leaders, and we came away with three recommendations from this council. Now, the council gave us as academic leaders lots to chew on, and our faculty are involved in these initiatives that we're now launching within our campus. So we are thinking intentionally about how we prepare AI-ready Spartans. So how do we build digital competencies across all of our undergraduate experiences by prioritizing AI through an industry-backed, employer-informed approach? So really our goal is to ensure that every graduate can use AI effectively and responsibly and ethically. This is a game changer. AI has been around for a long time, but certainly in the last 2, 3, maybe 4 years, it has become ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We're using the technology, whether we know it or not. And we're hearing from our industry partners that our Spartans may be lacking in some of those competency skills, as well as their employees may rely on the university to upskill and continually train and provide opportunities to grow in those that lifelong learning. So we're spending quite a bit of time. We've invited our faculty to develop proposals to embed AI in some of the coursework. And we're introducing some exploratory courses. Again, this is faculty-led work, so industry-backed, industry-informed. But the key here is that faculty own the curriculum. That's part one. Part two is we're thinking very intentionally about how we ensure every undergraduate gains access to career exploration and real-world experience. So through our Career Connected Spartans initiative, we are thinking intentionally about how we develop an ecosystem for our Spartans to explore career opportunities day one when they get on our campus. So that's through our new student orientations and exploring opportunities right from the beginning. But before they get to our campus, thinking about planting the seeds for career exploration in that pre-college space. So we do a lot of outreach and engagement through K-12, and we're actually starting to do more and more of that, and not just through our recruitment. We're recruiting record sizes in classes, and our enrollment is strong, but really thinking about how we prepare those K-12 students to enter into the world of work or higher education. So being career-focused is another very important initiative that has come out of the Green and White Council. So when we think about preparing our Spartans for future jobs, it's knowing what the market is telling us now, but also creating the skill sets, the soft skills, but also the technical skills for our Spartans to thrive in the careers that they choose. Now, back in my day, you picked a career and maybe you stayed with it throughout a lifetime.
Yeah.
And we know that that's changing. And so we want our Spartans to have a variety of opportunities to explore, to take risks, to develop skills, problem solving, empathy, perspective taking. And so this is an important intention that we are embedding throughout our curriculum with the help of our faculty and our general education curriculum, which is under development right now.
Provost McIntyre, this is fantastic work. And, you know, as one of the co-chairs of the Green and White Council, I don't think I could have laid it out any better. So thank you very much for laying it out for us.
You are most welcome.
All right. Well, Laura Lee McIntyre, who's the new provost, been there about a year at Michigan State, you're off and running and doing a phenomenal job. Thank you. As a Spartan, thank you very much for the work that you're doing and for your leadership. And have a great weekend.
Thank you. Go green.
Go white.
Go white. And keep it right here. JR Morning continues after this.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Matt Elliott here with Lloyd Jackson. And Lloyd, the World Cup kicks off for the United States tonight.
Tonight, 9 o'clock, Paraguay.
And every single World Cup game will be played on turf engineered at Michigan State University. And we're lucky enough to have the professor who led this work, Trey Rogers, join us. Trey, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Good morning.
We're thrilled to have you. Thank you for joining us. And also, I'm sure you're busy these days. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of how you and your partner at the University of Tennessee, you know, were asked to develop by FIFA this special turf for the World Cup.
The genesis might have started way back in the Pontiac Silverdome when we were successful the first time in moving that field. So they became confident that, you know, that we had some game, so to speak, and they just kind of just told us that, you know, we want to do something even bigger and bolder than we've ever done before, which is hosted in three countries, 16 stadiums, and eight of the stadiums don't have natural grass in them, you know, most of the time, dome stadiums. Hey, can you help us? And luckily, they came to us in 2019, 2020, so we've been had a lot of time to work on this because it's been, you know, quite the challenge and a long road.
Trey, you know, I'm just wondering, how do you replicate everything grass needs, sunlight, soil conditions, drainage, durability, inside a controlled environment?
Well, that project, which is at the University of Tennessee, it's not difficult to do that. I mean, they just kind of close that up and then control the environment, control the temperature. We know how to build fields, and we will build them inside of there. Then most important thing for us to do once we're in there is begin to simulate the traffic. And that's really the trick. It's not so whether or not grass can grow well if it just sits there and looks good. We need to know how is it going to repair. What kind of light levels are we going to need? And that's why, you know, you might see some pictures now of LED lights out over the tops of stadiums when there's no games at all. Like right now, they've probably got the lights on in Guadalajara. Mm-hmm. repairing from the damage.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I learned as we were getting ready for this, Trey, is the fact that the concept or the technology you're using is actually sod on plastic. And that's what I think one of the things you developed to make grass grow in the Silverdome in 94. Tell us a little bit more about what that actually entails.
Well, it's just like the name sounds. I mean, it's nothing sexy. It's just growing your sod on a piece of plastic instead of in the soil. And one of the things, if you've ever put sod down in your yard or been involved in that, the first thing the guy screams at you, that's the gardener, he says, you got to water, water, water. And the reason they're telling you that is because the plant has to totally, totally reestablish a root system from the crown of the plant. Of course, when you grow it on plastic and you pick it up, think about picking up a piece of pizza, the roots that are underneath there, they're not encumbered. They're not cut off. They come up and they're physiologically intact. They can be transported. And so that plant doesn't have to spend any energy once it gets laid down on the ground to maybe put a new root system out. And it's a beautiful thing. We can go from farm to stadium, play immediately.
And that's amazing. And you also then have to knit the grass together to make it playable. Is that right?
Well, the pieces themselves, they weigh about 3,500 pounds each. So once you slam them together, they're ready to play. What the knitting or it's a reinforcement. That's a FIFA requirement because of all the traffic that's on the fields, they want this reinforcement. And it's either needled into the ground or it comes in a carpet that's grown at the stadium. I mean, it's grown at the sod farm. And that's because one game of a World Cup equals the traffic of a Super Bowl. And I'm not just talking about the players, but all the rehearsals and everything else that goes into that. So some of these stadiums are about to have 9 Super Bowls. That's a lot of
time. Yeah. And Trey, how much does surface quality actually impact the game itself? I'm talking about player safety and speed and performance.
Well, this is the sport. This is the sport that if you think about a soccer pitch, this is the sport that is more like a golf green than it is like a football field. Uh-huh. And that is because ball roll plays such an important point. And so the smoothness, the techniques that have to be taken into account to keep the ball smooth, to keep the ball bouncing properly, a lot more than than in the football field, obviously. If the football field, if the ball's on the ground, somebody's about to blow a whistle. In this game, it's all about the ball roll. Now, as far as the players having confidence that when they step and they can turn and the grass is going to be, you know, supporting them, well, that's all sports. That doesn't really matter what sport we're talking about. But the ball roll here is really a separator for the sport of soccer.
Well, Trey, you just mentioned types of grass, and I'm a golfer, so I'm a bit of a grass geek. In the 30 seconds we have left, tell us, what varieties of grass have you used for these fields?
There's two grasses. If it's a cool season grass, we've used Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass at a mixture, a ratio, and that ratio was determined by our research at Michigan State. The other is a Bermuda grass. Those are going into the warm season climates. But all the dome stadiums, whether we're in Houston or Vancouver, they are cool season grasses because of the light requirement. That warm season grass is just too great. We needed to use a cool season grass, so it's kind of cool.
Well, congratulations, Trey, on seeing 7-8 years worth of research and deep work and really decades of research come to fruition here as the United States hosts the World Cup. Thanks very much for joining us today, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Who's our final guest, Matt?
Our final guest is going to be Blake Rockwell. So he's the founder of an organization called Special Spectators, which is a nonprofit that provides Make-A-Wish-style game day experiences for critically and terminally ill kids. Blake is a wonderful guy, and he does phenomenal work. It'll be a lot of fun to talk to him.
And Blake joins us next at 8:49 on JR Morning.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's Matt Elliott here with Lloyd Jackson. And joining us right now is Blake Rockwell. Blake is the founder of a nonprofit called Special Spectators, and it's going to be a lot of fun to have Blake tell you more about it. Blake, good morning.
Good morning, Lloyd and Matt.
We're really glad to hear you, have you here, Blake. So, Blake, let's start off by telling everyone a little bit about Special Spectators. What does Special Spectators do, and who does it serve?
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. Special Spectators is a Detroit-based nonprofit organization that creates transformative and memorable VIP all-access game day experiences for seriously ill children and their families at sporting events across the United States. We got our start in 2002, which means that this upcoming college football season is our 25th campaign. And since 2002, we have hosted over 10,000 patients, parents, and siblings in all at almost 500 games.
And Blake, one of your early major partners, I understand, was Coach Pat Fitzgerald of Northwestern. How did that relationship help shape the early growth of the organization?
Yeah, Coach Fitz has been a huge supporter of Special Spectators. I've known Fitz for 20 years. We first met at the 2006 Big Ten Media Day, and he's been a huge supporter of our organization from day one. He's been completely engaged and all in. If you know Fitz, he brings the juice to everything, every second, and he's fully supported Special Spectators, and I'm excited to announce publicly right here on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes and the flagship station of MSU Athletics that Special Spectators will be at Michigan State, thanks to Fitz, and as well as the MSU football chief of staff, Jacob Schmidt, marketing head, LaRonda Burley, and the head of MSU Sports Properties, Otis Wiley, all teaming together to give some local seriously ill kids an incredible Spartan experience at Spartan Stadium this season.
That's great news.
That is fantastic news, Blake, and we're glad you're delivering for MSU. We appreciate that. When you think about what that day will look like, you know, for the patient and their family, walk us through quickly what that experience is like for a child.
Yeah, thank you. So a game day experience for a seriously ill kid and their families, because we like to get as much of the family members involved as possible because everyone's impacted by this illness. We of course, get them to the stadium extremely early because they're getting into the locker room before the guys arrive. And they get to try on their favorite player's helmet and equipment and slide their little tiny foot in a size 20 cleat. We get them involved in you know, a unique tradition that might be taking place at the host school. So for Michigan State, it might be the walk from Kellogg Center to Spartan Stadium. We do a tailgate because if you're going to a college football game, you got a tailgate. But it's a G-rated tailgate, not what Matt Elliott for doing outside Spartan Stadium. But and so we do a tailgate, and we'll have special guests come to that tailgate. It might be cheerleaders, the mascot, you know, part of the marching band, famous alum, people like that, other student athletes also within the athletic department. Then it's off to the stadium and being on the sidelines for the pregame warm-up and just being arm lengths from the guys as they're warming up. Sometimes our kids serve as honorary captains and will participate in the actual in the coin toss with the actual team captains. It's being announced to the crowd, which is my favorite element of our game day experience. So imagine a group of kids who are just going through so much, standing in front of 75,000-80,000 at Spartan Stadium, being announced to them and just having the loudest standing ovation for these kids. And then, of course, it's watching the game and then hopefully back to the locker room, maybe post game for a celebration. That's kind of what our typical game day experience looks like with the dozens of partners who we partner with across the country.
You know, and something very powerful about sports, creating that break from medical treatments.
Absolutely.
And hospital visits and, you know, difficult routines. It's important to have that sense of a normal childhood in what you're doing. I mean, it's making them just feel normal just for that time.
Absolutely. And that's a big thing that we hear from our families. It's just having the opportunity to have normalcy return to their lives. And also to, obviously, these kids get injected with a lot of things in the hospital. And
yeah.
What we're injecting them with is just pure joy, excitement, fun, memories, laughter that they get to share with their families during that extremely difficult time. You know, it's not unusual for families to tell us, holy cow, this is the first time I've seen my child smile since their diagnosis or since whatever. But what really touches at the heartstrings and is even more powerful is when you hear a small child say the same thing about their parents. And you kind of realize the guilt that child is carrying, even though they have no control over their illness, the guilt that child is feeling about how their illness is impacting the family. And for them to finally see their illness bring something good to the family is a huge relief for the kids too. And you get to see that weight be lifted off of their shoulders throughout our game day experience. It's incredibly powerful. And then the other benefit real quickly is that a lot of these kids have been going through a lot. This is all that they know for their entire life. And their batteries start to run low, man. I mean, their tanks are running dry. They're running on fumes. And we hear from doctors, nurses, child life specialists, other people in the hospital, after their game day experience, they'll say, holy cow, that kid is a whole new kid after going to game day, and they are now fighting their fight with a whole new vigor and a whole new energy. And so the benefits of going to game day are just endless, and they're so powerful, more powerful than I could have imagined when I created the organization 25 years ago.
And you know what, Blake, we've known each other for that full 25 years, and the arc and the growth of what you've done is incredible. In the 30 seconds or so we have left, tell us a little bit about how our listeners can get involved, because this is an all-volunteer organization.
We are a completely volunteer organization with 200 volunteers across the country. And people can go online onto our Special Spectators website, specialspectators.org. That's .org. And you'll see a donation button, right, orange button right at the top of our website. Click on that donation, if you would, please, and donate to Special Spectators, because it's critical for us. The more money we raise means the more kids we're able to serve. And it also means the greater game day experience we're able to create for the kids that we serve. And, you know, we're looking not only for support from individuals, but from the corporate community, from the philanthropic community, and from the sports community here in Michigan and southeastern Michigan, the Detroit area, because there's a lot of exciting things going on, not just in the amateur athletic world, but we also would love to move into the professional sports world also.
And we'll pick that one up next time. But Blake Rockwell, founder of Special Spectators, thank you so much for the work that you do, and we'll look forward to seeing you this fall in Spartan Stadium. Take care.
Thank you, guys. We're so excited. It starts 12 weeks from tomorrow.
All right, Matt Elliott, thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend, my friend.
I will do that. You too. Thank you very much.
All Talk is next.